Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unexpected good news from the chairman of the FCC, who apparently will move to have the internet reclassified as a telecommunications service instead of an information service under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. That means a big win for net neutrality advocates and open internet protection. Sasha Meinrath, the director of the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative, joins us to discuss this major move to protect consumer broadband internet from further monopoly control and paid prioritization of favored content, and what efforts the Republicans in the service of the telecom and cable monopolies can mount to derail the ruling that will be voted on by FCC commissioners later this month. Then we'll examine today's confirmation hearings for the new Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, before the Senate Armed Services Committee, with William Hartung, the Director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. We'll discuss the relatively mild treatment Carter got from the Republicans, given that he is an Obama appointee, and the increase in the defense budget, which, if the Coast Guard, pensions and veterans affairs and other military costs were included, would be $1 trillion, more than enough when compared to Russia's just increased defense budget of $50 billion. Then finally, we will speak with Laura Perna, a professor and founding executive director of the Alliance for Higher Education and Democracy, AHEAD, at the University of Pennsylvania, about the new report she co-authored, Indicators of Higher Education Equity in the U.S. 45 Years Trends Report, at www.ahead-pen.org, which finds the completion gap between rich and poor students has doubled, with 99% of students from the highest income group graduating by 24, while just 21% of students from the lowest income families finish by that age. And joining us now is Sasha Meinrath, who directs the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative, and he is the research director of the Foundation's Wireless Future Program. He's also the co-founder of Measurement Lab, a distribution platform for researchers around the world, and coordinates the Open Source Wireless Coalition, a global partnership dedicated to the development of open source, low-cost wireless technologies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sasha Meinrath.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
And it's also a pleasure to be talking about some good news for a change, and that is that the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Tom Wheeler, has indicated that he plans to reclassify the internet as a telecommunications service instead of an information service under Title II of the Telecommunications Act. And this has been the Gordian knot. Everybody has wondered why this could not be done, since it was basically undoing what Michael Powell did a number of years ago. So, first of all, is this really happening? I guess that's my question.
Well, all signs point to yes. And, of course, it's Washington, D.C., so you shouldn't count chickens before they're hatched. But, you know, the chairman has made it very clear that he is going to follow the same series of solutions that public interest groups have now been laying claim to for near on a decade in terms of reclassifying broadband connectivity under Title II. And the irony is, this is exactly where broadband was carved out from about 10 years ago.
And again, that was Michael Powell, of course. And I think one of the predecessors in the FCC once basically said, you know, that the internet is just like another toaster or something along those lines.
Yes. And in fact, Michael Powell said that not having broadband connectivity was a Mercedes divide, i.e., in his mind, connectivity was a luxury good. And we, of course, now know that that is not the case, that it is increasingly essential across a variety of different facets of our lives, and that those that do not have access to the digital resources that are available online are inherently disadvantaged when it comes to participating in a 21st century digital economy.
And how much do you think that the fact that the president recently weighed in on this issue and urged the FCC to take this step?
So President Obama ran in 2008 on a strong network neutrality platform. It was an explicit plank in his presidential run, and had, in essence, been quiet for the past 6 years on this. So the president then coming out and reiterating that he still stands by his original platform, I think, was a game changer here in Washington, D.C., because it moved the debate from one of kind of splitting the baby and going with these hybrid approaches that no one could figure out how they would work technologically, legally, et cetera, to the clarity of putting information services back under a clear mandate, which is Title II, which is, of course, the same regulatory authority that covers things like telephones. And as you and I both know, like, telephones haven't ceased to exist and telephone services hasn't been destroyed by that kind of consumer protection regime.
And the logic there is, or the comparison there is, that the telephone companies just provide the wires. They don't decide what conversations you have.
Exactly. And they can't discriminate because we're talking about something that they don't like. And they can't decide not to interconnect you and me because you might have a different provider than me. In essence, under Title II, things like standardization of the telephone services, interconnection mandates, and the interconnection between different telephone networks, which historically is not where telephone began, all became possible, in fact, mandated due to Title II.
And again, I'm speaking with Sacha Meinrath, who directs the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative, and he is the research director of the Foundation's Wireless Future Program and also co-founder of Measurements Lab, a distribution platform for researchers around the world. And he also coordinates the Open Source Wireless Coalition, a global partnership dedicated to the development of open source, low-cost wireless technologies. So how much do you think in the upcoming debate, because the Republicans are definitely opposed to this, is this a done deal? He's got the power to do this, and they don't, the opponents or those that are, you know, basically being lobbied or carrying the water, shall we say, for the big telecom companies like Verizon, AT&T, and the cable companies like Comcast and Time Warner. Do they have a counterattack here?
So the reality is that the figurative devil will be in the details. And so on February 26th, there will be a vote, and it does look all but certain that that vote will put information services under Title II. And at that point in time, it will open up three new battlefronts. So the first will be the inevitable lawsuits that are brought by Internet service providers. And in that regard, I think the FCC is actually on firm legal ground. We have 80 years of precedent regarding Title II and a lot of these kinds of services. The second battleground will be in Congress and on the Hill. And it will most likely test Obama's mettle in terms of standing firm for Title II reclassification. And I would expect that Congress members will attempt to attach various riders and et cetera onto other legislation to try to undermine this decision by the FCC. But the third battlefront, which I think is actually going to be the most problematic, will be something called forbearance. And this is the idea that the FCC can say, well, we're going to put it under this legal umbrella, Title II, but we can decide whether or not to apply specific forms of consumer protections and other regulations to the Internet. And in that regard, I think the doors are wide open. We don't really know what kind of Title II protections will actually be applied to the Internet. And for me, that's very scary because obviously that, if you wanted to undermine the spirit of Title II, you could do that through forbearance.
Well, I assume that some people, and I know you are thinking about how the United States, the country that developed the Internet, has been slipping behind further and further with the rest of the advanced industrial countries, particularly in terms of cost and speed of the Internet. And countries like France have 1 gigabit service, as to South Korea, Japan, and other countries at a fraction of the cost that we pay for. And the average in the United States is a scandalously low 9 megabits per second, as opposed to, you know, 1,000 or a gigabit per second. Mm-hmm. So, and there's only a few places in the country where that service is available, and it's available via local utilities, like in Chattanooga, Tennessee, for example. And then to impose this crappy service on us, a lot of these big monopolies like Verizon have been suing in the states and municipalities to prevent municipalities from having fiber optic high-speed broadband available to their citizens in their communities. And every time you get this service in any community, suddenly business takes off like it is here in Santa Monica and around the country. And I think somewhere in the middle of Iowa, they're booming because they have this public service that ought to be available to everybody, and it isn't because of this lousy monopolistic or oligopolistic system we have. I mean, isn't that what it's all about at the end of the day?
Yeah, I mean, you've put out a passionate series of empirically backed statements, right, that the U.S. today pays far more for service in far fewer locations than a growing list of other countries. And that has profoundly detrimental implications for our 21st century digital economy. It has profoundly bad implications for our global competitiveness. And so one of the reasons why the White House has come out and said, we need to undo these barriers to entry that have been erected in some 20 states. We actually need to maximize the options available to local communities. Whatever they decide should be what's supported for providing broadband service provision. And so, in essence, what we're seeing is, I hope, a turning of the tide, one from more and more restrictions placed upon meaningful competition to one where, at a national level, we understand that, look, if you have meaningful competition in the broadband market, you need far less government intervention to protect consumers. But what you cannot do, and what we're coming out of 10 years of doing, is pretending like there's meaningful competition. Like your listeners could call up a dozen different companies and get a dozen different offers for broadband service at their home. We know that that doesn't exist in most places in the country. So my hope is that through the FCC's action, through the White House's action, that we're going to see, hopefully, a lot more competition in these spaces.
So how much do you think, though, that it will, in other words, will moving to Title II, the FCC moving to Title II, how do you get from A to B? In other words, if you remove the impediment of monopolies that control the market and are politically protected by through their enormous lobbying money that Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, and Time Warner pay on Capitol Hill, and presumably that's why the Republicans are still waging a last-ditch legislative effort to strip the FCC of the authority to enforce this internet protection. So how do we get from A to B so that, because the problem I've seen, Sasha, with this incredibly important issue, that one of the reasons that people don't get it is because it's so badly framed. Nobody knows what the hell net neutrality means. Mm-hmm. But if you were to say to the American people, look, you can get, 100 times the speed of your internet at a quarter of the cost, which is what the rest of the world, or at least the advanced industrial world, enjoys. And there's no reason why you should be gouged by your crappy cable or telecom service that gives you this poverty of choice at, lousy, increasingly bad service at increasingly greater cost.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, when I look at international broadband rankings, when I look at things like the empirical evidence, it perplexes me that in places like Romania, they're getting 10 times the speed for a fraction of the cost is what I can get in most American cities. Like, huge kudos to the Romanians for figuring that out. But if you look around the globe at countries that have done far better than we are, right, this is a pocketbook issue, and by far better, I mean people are paying less for better service than what we receive. The unifying elements of that are that they have either done rate regulation, which is kind of the big cudgel that government can wield, or they have meaningful competition. And we have done neither of those, and so we're suffering through a dozen years of kind of deferred oversight of a market that clearly is not best meeting the needs of American consumers. And you see this in cities where pricing is expensive. You see this in rural areas where service is non-existent. And that has hugely detrimental impacts on communities all across the country. And regulators and policymakers and legislators are only beginning to wake up to all of the different ways in which our lives are made worse when we ignore this growing problem.
So in terms of framing the debate, is there a chance then just to, now that we've net neutrality has gotten this tremendous shot in the arm, because the fear has been that it simply this would not happen, that somehow because Tom Wheeler comes out of the cable and telecom world as their former lobbyist, that he would side with the monopolies against the consumers. That doesn't appear to be happening here, but that doesn't mean the battle's over. So who's going to step up and make the kind of arguments, Sasha Meinrath, that are incredibly accessible to the public? As I say, for the longest time, the idea of this framing everything around this dubious concept of net neutrality is not the best framing.
Correct. And in fact, network neutrality is neither the solution nor the underlying problem. It is a symptom, and it is not going to fix everything that's gone awry with our market system right now. And if you look, I actually wrote a paper some 7-8 years ago called The New Network Neutrality Criteria for Internet Freedom, which is moving us beyond this notion that there's some sort of silver bullet. The solutions are going to require constant vigilance, right? It took 4 million Americans writing into the FCC. It took the President of the United States weighing in on this issue. It took 10 years of work by a whole coalition of public interest groups to get the FCC to do what all the evidence points is the right decision. And that doesn't just disappear on the 26th of this month. That is just the opening, the unfolding of a new series of interventions that has to happen. We have to ensure, we have to keep people's toes to the fire to ensure that what's actually put in place matches the rhetoric of what we're told is going to happen. So I have been a vocal and public critic of Chairman Wheeler, and I hope beyond hope that I'm utterly wrong and that I get to, you know, eat my hat and that he does the right thing and that we end up with strong consumer protections, that with the result being faster speeds for lower prices in more areas of the country than our global competitors. And if that happens, I welcome the opportunity to say publicly, I was wrong about the chairman. He did the right thing. We now have a vibrant consumer market for broadband service provision in the United States. But we will only get there through constant vigilance.
Well, I think that irrespective of whether Tom Wheeler had a sort of road to Damascus conversion here or not, the fact that 4 million American citizens wrote into the FCC, this is a record. They've never had anything like that. They literally, right, their phones have been jammed and their emails being jammed, and the fact that the president weighed in as well, that this is a manifestation of a democracy at work. And, you know, if this happened more often on all the important issues of the day, because a lot of people just basically feel alienated from politics and don't believe there's any difference between Democrats and Republicans and have checked out. This is, to my mind, is a living example of the opposite. That is, if you weigh in and make your voices heard, they can't ignore you.
That is my hope. And I would say that it is too early to know that that is how things will end up. All signs point to the power of the people influencing policy quite dramatically and directly. And D.C. has a funny way of pulling 11th hour switches and not quite getting to what people thought they had achieved. And so, again, like, I would caution anyone that's taking a victory lap now to make sure that you read what was actually passed on the 26th before drawing conclusions or lavishing praise or assuming that this problem is now behind us.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sasha Meinrath.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Sachin Bhinerath, who directs the New America Foundation's Open Technology Initiative, and he is the research director of the foundation's Wireless Future Program. He's also the co-founder of Measurement Lab, a distribution platform for researchers around the world, and coordinates the Open Source Wireless Coalition, a global partnership dedicated to the development of open source, low-cost wireless technologies. 100%.
Protect your eyes. Protect yourself from digital decay. Digital decay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Hartung, the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, and his latest, Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And the hearings today before the Senate Armed Services Committee and the confirmation of Ashton Carter to be the next Secretary of Defense, it seems as though the Republicans aren't really itching for a fight here. He seemed to have sort of breezed through this opening salvo.
Yeah, I think they think this is the best they're going to get, you know, in terms of the closest to their views. And he certainly was... seem to be close to their views on a lot of things. I think their hope was to use it as a way to get him to trash Obama, but he didn't fall for that. So,
and I take it that's in John McCain's question to him, to Ashton Carter, about the Islamic State, and particularly in the context of the brutal execution of the Jordanian pilot, saying, "Do we have a strategy at this time?" And Ashton Carter replying to John McCain's question by saying that, "I believe I understand our strategy." But he didn't actually say what it was, right?
And he didn't endorse it, whatever it was, except to say that there were two parts. There was an Iraq piece and a Syria piece. And that we needed partners, and that, you know, we were going to create partners in Syria through this training program. But, he did a good job of sort of neither committing or not committing himself to any number of things they asked about. The only thing I remember him saying no to was one of the senators wanted him to spend, said, "Well, what if we spent, what Gates would have spent if we kept his five-year plan, which would have been about $100 billion more than we're spending now." He said, "Isn't that what we need for, to protect the country?" And Carter said, "Well, we're not going to get that, so let's not talk about that." But other than that, there wasn't a lot of disagreement.
Well, a lot of the conversation, at least what Carter was trying to get across apparently, was he implored Congress to get rid of the sequester. And he's following in the footsteps there of all of the top brass in the country who have basically been lobbying Congress to do the same. So given the new defense budget put forth by President Obama, which is the first rise in the defense budget in 5 years, the trend lines have been going down on military spending, and now Obama is upping the ante and throwing a hell of a lot more money at the Pentagon. Since when has the Congress balked at having too much money thrown at the Pentagon?
Well, I think everybody on that committee wants as much money as possible, but none of them are able to swing any kind of deal to get rid of the sequester. It's going to be up to Mitch McConnell and the leadership with Harry Reid in the Senate. And the sticking point is the libertarians and the Tea Party types who really don't want to, none of the Republicans want to raise revenues. Tea Party types don't want the deficit to go up. and they want to gouge entitlements, which thankfully Obama doesn't want to do. So they've still got all those contradictions to work out. I mean, if the Republicans really thought that, you know, we're all going to die tomorrow if we didn't raise the Pentagon budget, you would think they could agree to some tax increases, but that is not the case. So perhaps it's not as dire as they say.
And again, I'm speaking with William Hartung, who's the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, and his latest book is Prophets of War. That's P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. So in terms of the military-industrial complex, my understanding is that Ashton Carter, even though he's supposed to have had doubts about the world's most expensive weapon system that apparently doesn't work, and that is the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, he's apparently asked, or at least Obama's budget has asked for $11 billion more for this turkey, and they also want to take $3.5 billion away from the A-10, which is apparently the only plane in the Air Force's inventory that troops on the ground really like and need because it saves their lives. But the Air Force, for reasons of its own, want to build these incredibly expensive planes to fight dogfights into the 21st century against air forces that don't exist.
Well, there is the problem. You know, Carter, in his prepared statement, said, you know, I wouldn't blame taxpayers for not wanting to give us more money because of all the cost overruns and we can't keep track of the books and so forth. But, you know, if those were the things he was truly concerned about, the F-35 would be a big part of the solution because it's, you know, as you said, it doesn't work. They're rushing it into production before they've worked out any number of bugs. I mean, the one for the Marines, which they want to call partially combat ready this year, can't. The bombing part doesn't work. They can't track enemy radar. They can't share information with other planes or with troops on the ground. The helmet that's supposed to give the pilot situational awareness keeps having false positives, you know, seeing targets aren't really there. And the Marines are saying, oh, but it's doing so much better than it was last year. You know, so it's kind of a joke. But I think the problem is the Air Force is so deep into it that, you know, they're not going to turn back. I think the Navy, would, if they, you know, had to let go of it, I don't think there'd be any great tears in the Navy. But the Air Force is, you know, is all in, and that's the biggest part of the F-35 purchase.
So my understanding is that at this point, the F-35 can't tell the difference between friend or foe.
That's right. They keep talking about numbers. You know, well, we had more tests last year than we had the year before, but not so much about outcomes. You know, the Pentagon's chief tester has just been generating these long laundry lists of what the thing can't do. Many of them link back to the fact that they can't get the software to work. And he hasn't gone so far as to say they can't, you know, do this, but that's really not his job. But, you know, everything substantive that he said indicates that the plan is a disaster.
So did the op-ed that Ashton Carter wrote, I think it was with Joe Nye, when they were both at the Kennedy School of Government during the Clinton administration, I think it was during the Clinton, or maybe it was during the Bush administration, where they argued that we should attack North Korea. Did that come up?
I didn't see that, no. I mean, it seemed like the Democrats were not really asking any hard questions, and the Republicans likewise, other than taking him on to be more hawkish, which I don't know that's really necessary. He has a pretty hawkish outlook as it is.
So in other words, nobody questions his hawkish credentials?
No, I think if anything, they viewed that as one of his primary qualifications.
Hmm. So was there any discussions then about the idea that the defense budget is now going back up again after 5 years, and is there any relationship between the threats out there and the defense budget? Heavens forbid that we talk about that, but was there any?
Yeah, well, I mean, they always give the list. You know, there's ISIS, there's Ebola, there's Ukraine. But, you know, whether or not you think there are military solutions to those problems, which I don't, but even if you agreed with that, they've got money to deal with the war in ISIL, about $5 billion. They've got money for this European reassurance initiative, less than $1 billion. So that's $6 billion out of $575 billion between the Pentagon's base budget and the war budget. So it's kind of a shell game, or, you know, they're trying to get double and triple dip using the same threats as justification, because they're talking about spending, you know, 1% or so of their budget on what they claim are the greatest threats faced by the United States. So clearly raises the question of, well, what's all that other stuff for, except to be, you know, other than to be ready for perpetual war, which I don't think really is a strategy.
Well, there were questions, though, about, there is a war going on at the moment in Ukraine, and it's pretty one-sided. You know, Russia's already taken Crimea and is attacking Ukraine, and there's just no two ways about it. They're making advances now, the so-called rebels, because there are 9,000-plus Russian regular troops with the most advanced equipment against this pretty decrepit Ukrainian army. So there is a war going on, and now the question is, what does the U.S. do about it?
Well, I think the Obama people, I almost said the Clinton people, the Obama people are now leaning towards sending lethal assistance, which they had resisted because they thought it would just further alienate Putin and it would, you know, undermine the possibilities of negotiations and so forth. But now that the Russian forces and their allies in Ukraine have made so much progress and Putin has really, he hasn't slowed down because of the sanctions or anything else. Now their new argument is that it will, if they can bolster the Ukrainian government forces enough to either, you know, push back the other side or come to some kind of standstill, then they can get again to the point where there might be negotiations. But in terms of spending money, I mean, you know, sending some weaponry is not going to cost you hundreds of billions of dollars. So there's still sort of this disconnect between the threats that they throw out there and the amount of money that they want to spend.
Well, I was just reading a story today, William Hartung, that showed a picture of Vladimir Putin holding up a brand new iteration of the AK-47 assault rifle. And the article was about how, in spite of the sanctions and the decline in the Russian economy due to the drop in the price of oil, that nevertheless Putin's increasing the defense budget. But guess what he's increasing the defense budget to?
Oh, I would guess, you know, 1/5 or less what we're spending.
$50 billion.
There's your big buildup, yeah.
It's a 12th of our budget, right?
Yeah, once you count the war spending.
And then you add, the Pentagon budget is always lowballed because, you know, the Coast Guard is off in a different, it's in Homeland Security, isn't it now? And you've got pensions hidden in other budgets, et cetera. So it's, the real figures are much greater than even the acknowledged ones.
Yeah, probably over $1 trillion by the time you count all the military-related items, you know, spread out through the rest of the budget. So, you know, that issue never comes up when there's the outcry about starving the national security state for resources.
So there's no change underway. In fact, if anything, it's change for the worse, not change for the better, in terms of having a rational defense budget that relates to the threats and having a national discussion about priorities, guns and butter and et cetera. I mean, we have...
No.
Yeah.
I mean, the logjam over taxes and the deficit might keep the Pentagon from getting everything it wants, but that wouldn't be because we had a rational conversation about what the country needs to defend itself. It would have been a byproduct of fighting over something else.
But my understanding is that in this latest budget of Obama's, with its, $585 billion for the Pentagon, you've got this budget apparently is the lowest in history in terms of the discretionary spending available. In other words, everything else, non-defense, has been cut to the bone. There's nothing left.
There's really not. I mean, and of course, we've been in a period where the needs for a lot of those programs have increased. And the fact of this, you know, that employment unemployment has gone down hasn't changed the levels of inequality or the fact that there's many more people in need of government services than there were, you know, before the recession hit. So not only have they been cut dramatically, but they've been cut versus growing needs.
So in terms of the Ashton Carter's appearance before the Senate Armed Services Committee and questions about the F-35, were there questions about the Air Force's determination to try and kill off the A-10, which is an old weapon system, but the only one that really works in terms of ground support, and it's beloved by, you know, soldiers from Afghanistan and Iraq because they feel that this is the one that saved their lives, as opposed to these high-flying, expensive platforms that travel at 900 miles an hour and drop bombs. My understanding is, for example, Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, who's on the committee, she's one of the people who's defending the A-10 and thwarting the Air Force's efforts to kill the program to save the $3.5 billion and then transfer it to this Turkey, the F-35, the most expensive weapon system in the history of man. And that because there's a whole bunch of lobbying from veterans and military officers, and I believe Kelly Ayotte's husband is a former A-10 pilot, where does that battle stand?
Well, she raises it at, you know, pretty much every opportunity. And I can't recall that, you know, as usual, Carter really committed himself to anything. But the only flaw in her approach is that she, instead of saying, well, this does a better job at close air support, therefore we don't need the F-35 to do that, therefore we need fewer F-35s, she's sort of taking a both-and approach. She doesn't want to challenge the F-35 program. So I think that puts her in a less viable position. But I think there is enough support in the Congress that they may be able to, you know, keep that program alive. But, you know, again, it'll be without changing the other programs. So there'll be this redundancy. You'll be paying for the F-35, which does a terrible job at what the A-10 can do, nominally for the same mission. So, I was surprised at first that she was doing this. And, you know, the A-10 doesn't have a big industrial, base behind it because they're already, you know, produced and they have to be maintained and such. But and I think that's the other reason it's in the crosshairs, that there's nothing there for the military-industrial complex, unlike with the F-35.
Well, William Hartung, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with William Hartung, who is the director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His books include How Much Are You Making in the War, Daddy? A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration. And his latest book is Profits, that's P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Laura Perner, who's a professor and founding executive director of the Alliance for Higher Education and Democracy, AHEAD, at the University of Pennsylvania. Her research examines the ways that social structures, educational practices, and public policies promote and limit college access and success, particularly for individuals from lower-income families and racial ethnic minority groups. She's the co-author of the new study, Indicators of Higher Education Equity in the United States, 45 Years Trends Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laura Perner.
Thank you very much.
And in terms of your findings, where the report indicates that there's a growing gap between rich and poor students in the United States, in fact, that the gap has doubled, is that a continuing trend line?
So the important finding here with regard to the growing gap in attainment, I think, so the report points to a number of different higher education outcomes that continue to vary across groups based on family income. One of the really important findings, I think, has to do with the growing gap in the likelihood of bachelor's degree attainment based on family income, and that gap has gotten larger over time. Part of what's happened is that educational attainment for those from the lowest family income groups has remained relatively unchanged over time, but over the years, the share of students from the highest income families who are completing at least a bachelor's degree has been increasing.
So if this, but again, is this is an ongoing trend? In other words, are there any indications that they're likely to get better, these trends, or get worse?
One indication of some progress in the report is that the gap in college enrollment rates by family income has narrowed a bit. Now, it's still substantial. Students from higher income families are still substantially more likely to go to college than students from lower income families. But there is a slight narrowing of the gap.
And what will President Obama's recent proposal for the 2 years of college free, is that aimed at plugging this gap or reversing this trend?
I think that proposal is important for several reasons. So first, it recognizes how important college affordability is to addressing the gap in attainment and recognizing how important money really does matter in terms of whether or not students, and particularly students from the lowest family incomes, can go to college. So from that perspective, the proposal is really important. There's another aspect of the proposal that I think is also important. It begins to try to specify what the roles of different stakeholders are in this process. So it specifies a contribution from the federal government. It specifies an obligation from state governments. It identifies a role for colleges and universities, and it specifies a responsibility for students and their families. If we're really going to make progress on this indicator and this really important outcome for our individuals and society, we really do need a comprehensive approach.
So the president's proposal is estimated to cost $60 billion over 10 years, and in the Republican-controlled Congress, there's little expectation that he will get that money. Do you have any proposals for finding a way out of the gridlock in Washington?
No, I wish that I did. I think that making progress on this issue is so important for individuals and society. We are all better off when educational attainment improves and when the gaps across groups decline. You know, the big gaps that we have here have really powerful negative implications for the economic and social stratification of our society. I would argue to Congress that this proposed investment is relatively small, and it's important in terms of the vast benefits that could be realized from the investment.
Well, I take it one of the big issues is the growing gap in completion of education. And apparently 99% of students entering colleges from the highest income families, those making $108,650,000 or more a year, graduate by 24, whereas just 21% of students from the lowest income families finish by that age. That's a huge difference, 99% versus 21%.
Yes, that's a really big difference. There's several things going on there that I think are worth and important to pay attention to. So one of the reasons for those differences has to do with differences in the types of colleges, universities in which students from different family income groups tend to attend. So students from higher income families are, on average, attending institutions with higher graduation rates. They're also more likely to enroll in four-year colleges in general, and that indicator that you just reported has to do with completion of a bachelor's degree. So students who start out in a four-year colleges are more likely to complete a four-year or a bachelor's degree than students who start out at other types of universities. There's another important driver of this, of that statistic, and that has to do with academic preparation and readiness for college. The schools, the K-12 schools that students from low-income families tend to attend generally have fewer resources in them that get them academically ready for college than the schools that students from higher income families tend to attend.
Okay, sorry, we're just...
That was a little convoluted.
No worries. Unfortunately, studio door was left open. Again, I'm speaking with Laura Perner, who is a professor and founding executive director of the Alliance for Higher Education and Democracy AHEAD at the University of Pennsylvania. Her research examines the ways that social structures, educational practices, and public policies promote and limit college access and success, particularly for individuals from lower-income families and racial ethnic minority groups. She is the co-author of a new study, Indicators of Higher Education Equity in the U.S. 45 Years Trends Report. And that study is available at www.ahead-penn.org. Now, the Pell Grants have been a longstanding effort to bring about equity in education and to subsidize lower-income students. But my understanding is that the Pell Grants nowadays only cover 60% of college costs. They covered 67% of college costs in 1975, but now they only cover 27%.
That's correct. And this is another important issue that's highlighted in the report. The federal Pell Grant is a very important mechanism that the federal government has made available to try to improve college affordability and try to begin to level the playing field for students from low-income families. One challenge is that increases in the Pell Grant over time have... one challenge is that the federal Pell Grant has increased at a slower rate than the cost of attendance. And so that's the reason why the share of the cost of attendance that's covered by Pell Grant has declined over time.
Well, you know, the White House has often talked about the importance of Pell Grants, but one of the problems that it seems to me that when you have the president wanting to subsidize 2 years of college at the cost of $60 billion over 10 years, which is pretty much dead on arrival with the Republican Congress, at the same time, increased Pell Grants, and his most recent proposal, which is to fund community colleges. Obviously, there's just not the money's just not there, even if the ideas are. One area that I find extraordinary that gets subsidized by the taxpayer to the tune of between $30 and $40 billion a year is the for-profit college arena, and it would seem to me that is anybody looking at that? If there are too many requests for too many programs that we need, and not enough money for any of them, why not go after the for-profit colleges? Because that's where all that taxpayer money goes, and they have the worst outcomes, as far as I know, and they tend to be attracting minority students with enormous advertising budgets, which the taxpayer pays for, and they have the worst graduation rates, and they essentially, a lot of them give students worthless diplomas and saddle them with a lifetime of debt.
Right. So you're raising a number of important issues here. So one very important characteristic about the federal Pell Grant in particular is that it's very specifically targeted towards students with the greatest financial need. And so from that perspective, the federal Pell Grant is a really important policy lever for addressing the financial barriers that face students from low-income families. So community colleges are a very important point of entry for students, especially students from low-income families. One of the issues that we need to pay attention to is the ability of students who start in a community college to successfully move into a four-year degree. For those who are interested in moving on to complete a bachelor's degree, there are a number of places in our educational pipeline where students get lost. And so one of those transition points is between K through 12 education and higher education. You can see that with the high rates of participation in remedial education. We also lose a great number of students as they try to transfer academic credit as they move from one institution to another institution. One of the challenges of our higher education system in the U.S. is both its strengths. So one of the strengths of the U.S. higher education system is that there are so many different post-secondary educational outcomes. Hypothetically, there is an option out there for everyone, but that's also a challenge. So figuring out how to help students successfully maneuver around the system, how to help them make the choices that are right for them, how to help them understand how to appropriately finance their education. These are all challenges and areas to be doing better.
So, but what about the idea that we're already spending this enormous amount of taxpayers' money on the for-profit colleges, which aren't performing and the taxpayers not getting their money's worth, not to mention the students?
Right. So there are issues with many different institutions. So we also have some public institutions and not-for-profit institutions with low completion rates. We really need to be paying attention to ensuring that students who start at an institution, whatever it might be, are able to get the support, have the resources that they need in order to persist to completion. We know that the outcomes for students in terms of labor market outcomes, in terms of ability to repay loans, a whole host of outcomes are better for students who finish. So that's something that we definitely have to be paying more attention to.
Well, one of the odd things is, Laura Perna, that almost every politician that runs for president or for higher office in this land says I'm a champion of education. So what's going on here? You know, we have worsening outcomes and more pledges of apparent interest in education. How does that strike you?
Right. So we need more than rhetoric on this issue. With Joni Finney, a colleague of mine here at the University of Pennsylvania, she and I published a book in April called The Attainment Agenda. We did studies of five U.S. states and tried to understand the relationship between public policy and higher education outcomes in those states. One of the lessons from our work has been that policy leadership really matters. So all states and our nation, we have many, many different public policies, many institutional practices that have been in place that are somehow related to improving higher education attainment. The key is to figure out how to orient those policies so that they collectively really achieve our goal of trying to improve overall attainment, closing gaps across groups in attainment. And doing that is going to require policies that are oriented towards the goal, policies that are oriented towards closing gaps in attainment. And we also need to have political leadership in order to create a shared public agenda, really create this commitment to not only stating that we have a goal of improving educational attainment, but really mobilizing the resources that we have available to achieving that goal.
So when in your study do you find, Laura Perna, that college completion for students from the wealthiest families have risen dramatically, climbing from 44% to 77%. What does that mean, though? Does that mean that it's all about money? Are there any other factors in why the kids from wealthier families are completing college more successfully and in greater numbers than kids from poorer colleges? Are there other societal factors at play here?
So I think there are a number of things going on. So in this country, family income is correlated with a lot of other types of opportunities and advantages. So one example is the extent to which the resources that are available in the schools that students attend vary based on the the incomes of the families of students who are attending those schools. So those differences in the resources that students have available early on in their educational pipeline vary tremendously based on their family income. In many ways, we have inequality structured into our system, our society, in ways that really has profound cumulative effects on students. And so in this report, when we look at bachelor's degree attainment, that's fairly far along on the educational pipeline. A lot of things have happened over time to result in those very profound and substantial differences.
Well, there have been programs, of course, to encourage enrollment in higher education for minority students. And in the state of California, of course, that was overturned by a referendum. And then when that happened, suddenly the numbers of minority students, particularly black and Latino students, dropped precipitously in the University of California system. So is there any recognition that that's counterintuitive, that the idea that somehow giving poor and minority students a leg up is somehow disadvantages white students, which is a bizarre argument, but nevertheless the one that sort of passed here in the state of California a couple of decades ago. What's the national mood on that?
Well, I think we've seen in a number of places challenges to using race-conscious policies. And so I think that's certainly an issue out there. You know, in our report, we highlight another type of difference that is talked about a little bit less frequently, and I think that's part of why our report has gotten so much attention, really trying to... So in our report, we draw attention to the profound differences based on family income. And so I think that making, reversing some of these trends and making meaningful progress and closing the gaps is going to require a more comprehensive approach. It's going to require a recognition about the ways in which inequality is structured into so many different opportunities that people have. It's going to require attention by the many different stakeholders that can and should play a role on this, so the federal government, state governments, institutions, schools, students and families.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Laura Perna.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Laura Perna, who's a professor and founding executive director of the Alliance for Higher Education and Democracy, AHED, at the University of Pennsylvania. Her research examines the ways that social structures, educational practices, and public policies promote and limit college access and success, particularly for individuals from lower-income families and racial ethnic minority groups. She is the co-author of the new study, Indicators of Higher Education Equity in the U.S., 45 Years Trends Report. And that report is available at www.ahead-pen.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.